Our second topic, India's role in the coming age. Well, this is a question that has been often asked. In the present chaotic situation of the world, has India got anything to contribute? If so, what? Yes, this is a question that Sri Aurobindo and the mother have often discussed, given very clear guidelines, and today in our allotted time, we shall see what it is. But before coming to India's role, I think what we should make clear is what do we mean by coming age. Because people commonly, both in India and outside India, especially in the Western countries, they feel that the future is going to be nothing but an age of mega technology, mega sciences. I mean, an endless improvement of the science and technology that we are having at present. I mean, when I was in Bangkok, I could see every second month there would be new models of computers, new models of TVs, with a little bit of change here and there, but technology was galloping. And the world thinks that that's what is going to be our future. From one to the other, we have gone to the moon now, we will go to Mars, we will go to Jupiter. And unfortunately, common man and even the educated, we think that is what is going to be the direction of the future world. Well, this is where we differ. Because even many influential writers in America have given us a vision of the next century. Well, you must have yourself read many articles and books on the coming century, the 21st century, the second millennium. I mean, there are many kinds of projections of what is going to come. But you will see one thing in common, that most of these projections are based on the present scientific research. So they would say, yeah, we'll have a spaceship, then they will say, we'll go have a colony in moon, and etc., and etc. But there are a few I have gone through who do visualize. In fact, I refer to Alvin Toffler in his book called The Power Shift, who has done a very fine analysis of the present situation, and he has a glimpse of a future where he speaks, I don't know under whose influence, of a new consciousness which he calls the third wave. He says there has been a wave of agriculture, a wave of industry, and very finally he says there would be a third wave of a new spiritual consciousness. And I was happy to read that, because here is a man who after reading Sri Aurobindo or under whatever his analysis, has given us a right thinking. But I assure you there are not many who think in these lines. And especially the Western governments, after the fall of the communist regime, the Americans think that they can make a new world order. Well, the new world order, they think is a new political power struggle based on economic struggle. The world is divided into economic pockets. But all that is one narrow way of thinking, I must say. Because what Sri Aurobindo would envisage is, quote Sri Aurobindo, "They must remember too that the new world whose coming we envisage is not to be made of the same texture as the old and different only in pattern." So remember the word he uses, texture, is not going to be of the same texture of consciousness. The present texture of consciousness is that of materialism. And he would say, it must be by other means, from within and not from without. So the new world that we envisage is a world that is going to be born from each one of us and not a reorganization of political fields and economic barriers. So the best way is not to be too much preoccupied with the lamentable things. And I think that's a wonderful line. Just this morning I was discussing with Manik Bhai, the newspaper that we read, the all the information that comes to us, is this exactly the word lamentable things? The newspaper gives us nothing but the lamentable things of our present situation. And we were in fact driving at this point, why do we have to always think of this negative thing? Why not think of the positive things happening in the world? And here is Sri Aurobindo advising us, so the best way is not to be too much preoccupied with the lamentable things that are happening outside, but themselves to free from within, so that they may be ready for the new world, whatever form it may take. And I remember now in the light of this, when the mother spoke to me, prepare yourself for the new world that is coming. So that preparation is that inner freedom. And that inner freedom, we will see as we go along, is nothing but the realization of your own inner being. So how beautifully in simple words Sri Aurobindo says, don't bother about the lamentable things and waste your consciousness and energy. Concentrate on your own self. And what the world would be externally, what does it matter to you? You start working on yourself. So this is the direction he gives of the new world. At the same time, when he says whatever form it may take, in his book The Ideal of Human Unity, Sri Aurobindo does trace a kind of an evolution of human society. And it does give us an idea of what is going to come. What kind of civilization are we looking forward to? It is not the new species he speaks of here, but a new age. Well, I'll give you very, in an absolute brief manner, the different stages. He says every human civilization, could I ask you to come a little this side? I mean, you are midway. I mean, I feel very funny here. Yeah, I cannot see you fully. I feel very uncomfortable. Sort of, you're hiding from me, you know, behind this board. Yeah. I have a habit of looking at everybody. So, he says every civilization goes through almost different stages which are common. A little bit of times may change, 100 years plus minus. But there is a common evolutionary stage in every society. He calls the first stage the symbolic age. The second one he calls the typal age. The third is the conventional age. Fourth is the individualistic age. Fifth is the subjective or the spiritual age. So you can see a gradual moving towards a kind of a spirituality. Now, if I'll just give you an example. This is an example given by Sri Aurobindo himself. He said, let's take the example of the Chaturvarna, the four castes, which is a common idea in India. He says, in the symbolic age, that is the age of the Vedas, we have seen yesterday. In fact, it's a nice continuation of yesterday's talk and today's. We have seen yesterday the whole evolution of spirituality in India. And today we will see its future. So you get in two lectures a whole idea of the past and the future of India, in Sri Aurobindo's words. So he says, this Chaturvarna, in the symbolic age, if we take up the caste system, questions are, was it also there during the Vedas? Yes. The caste system, not as it is as a system, but symbolically, the Vedic rishis had this kind of an understanding that human society, wherever it may be, whatever it may be, is divided into four different kinds of people. And the first one, in fact, this symbolism, they based on the analysis of Brahman himself. They said the Brahmin comes from the head of the Brahman. Kshatriya comes from his arms. Vaishya from his legs. And Shudra from his feet. So it is not any question of levels. Can we say my head is more important than my legs and my arms are less important than my head? In a human body, all the four are as important as anyone else. So there they did not distinguish the higher and the lower, but they only characterized that from the head of Brahman, one particular kind of knowledge goes, whom they call the Brahmins. And this is, the arms are always the strength. And they said, this is Kshatriya. And the legs were the movement, were the work. So they called it the Vaishya. And the Shudra, the feet, the work part. So this was a symbolic idea which was never put into strict form. Then he says, in the age of the tribal age, the second age, this form became a little more rigid, a little more formalized. And then people called it that by temperament, a man is a Brahmin or a Kshatriya or whatever, by temperament. Say for example, we are supposed to be Reddies. In Andhra Pradesh, Reddies are supposed to be Kshatriyas. But taken frankly, I don't have an iota of Kshatriyahood in me. I'm absolutely interested in knowledge aspect, wherever it is, Sri Aurobindo's knowledge. So my temperament is that of somebody who seeks knowledge. So similarly, not by caste or by birth, but by an individual's temperament, you could say this man is more of a Brahmin. So there was a tremendous flexibility. The caste system had not yet come in the tribal age, but they went by the temperament of the person. In fact, if you want to go deeper into that, we have the gunas, what the Gita explains as the each person is a combination of gunas. And each person has a domination of a particular guna. And depending on the guna of a rajas or a tamas or a sattva, the person's personality is there. However, so this was the tribal age. Then in the third age, the conventional age, yesterday we were talking about the shastras, that was the conventional age where birth became important. If you are a son of a Brahmin, then you are called a Brahmin. If a son of a Kshatriya, you are supposed to be a Kshatriya. So the birth and the economic activity became predominant, and the form became rigid. So like this, I mean, this is the conventional age. This is one simple system that Sri Aurobindo takes as an example. But if you can now analyze, the whole of Indian society was categorized in the similar way. And not only this, if you come to the West also, you go to China, you go to Japan, you go to Europe, this classification was always there under different names. There was the nobles, there was the warriors, there was the aristocracy. Everywhere this classification is a normal functional classification of a society. But in India, well, it was a conventional age in the West also. Don't think that the Western countries have been beyond class demarcation and beyond this conventional age. But this is where the conventional age comes. And then Sri Aurobindo goes to say, next comes the individualistic age. What is that individualistic age? It is the age when the individuals revolt against the convention. Obviously, when a convention kills the soul of a country, then some individuals have to revolt. Break down the forms so that the spirit again gets, you know, alive. This is the age of the individual. And next comes the subjective age, where there is a search for a true subjectivity. Who exactly am I? Well, this is very much in brief. Because after the individual, when the subjective age is, okay, now I'm free. The conventions don't hold me anymore. But then the search goes on, who am I? What exactly is man? Who is man? And there, the outer turns into a kind of inner search. Well, maybe it will be a little more clear if I give you some historic examples. Now, in India, the symbolic age was that of the Vedas. The typal age came on at the time of the Gita, etc. The conventional age came at the time of the Shastras. And from the Shastras onwards, India has this kind of a formation, a very rigid formation. And Sri Aurobindo says, even in the West, we had the same period of the symbolic, typal and the conventional. Now here comes something very interesting. Sri Aurobindo says, first in Europe, there was an uprising of the individualistic age. The whole world, almost if you see history right from China, because when I say the world, please remember the major countries are the Chinese civilization, the European and the Indian. This is where we really look into the world. Other countries are very small, they have not been much influential. But these are the three, at least in those times, I'm sure when they wrote today, America is there. But Sri Aurobindo says this individual age came first in Europe because Europe was at worst in conventional age. Let's not think that only India suffers of its conventional age. The worst things were happening in the West, in Europe, in England. So obviously where there is a suppression is greater, the individual revolts faster. And in the West, as you might have noticed, there was no religious freedom at all. One of the major differences in sociological differences is, in Europe, they did not have a religious spiritual freedom. They had a completely an individual social freedom. And in India, we had always a spiritual freedom, but we did not have a social freedom. Our society, our social bonds were very strict because of this caste system. We had this dharma of a kshatriya, dharma of a diskula, dharma of a nation. Everywhere our society was bound very, very rigorously. And an individual could not escape. The only escape route for an individual was to become an ascetic, where sannyasahood was beyond any social rules. Therefore, you see in India so many sannyasis. All those brilliant intellects who were really fed up with the social stringencies, the social laws which are binding common man. Any individual who wants to come out, society did not allow him to come out. So the only escape route being becoming an ascetic. So Indian society for a long time lost all its brilliant young people, because it's always the youth which revolts, and the youth, the revolting point was the door of asceticism. And therefore philosophies of Buddhism, of Shankara, or any negative thing, they sprouted in India because that was a very easy thing, because a sannyasin was beyond any law of any society. So unfortunately this has been the plague in the country, that we have lost our individuals, bright individuals in ascetic lines. I was coming to, in the West, there was no religious freedom. Christianity came down heavily on the individual. And where a man wanted to believe in anything else, religion did not allow him. And for a human being, this kind of a religious freedom is much more important than a kind of a social freedom. And therefore, in the West, Aurobindo analyzes that there was the revolt of the individual long back in the 17th century. And once the revolt of the individual came, religion was pulled down. And you know the history. First thing that was pulled down in the West was religion itself. Bible was challenged, popes were challenged, priests were challenged. And Bible was not even allowed to be read by the common man. It never happened that Gita could not be read in India. But here, it's only the fathers who had the prerogative to read the Bible, interpret it as they wanted it, to really rule the common man. So the first thing that was pulled down was the Bible and the religion. And so this kind of a religious upheaval, it resulted in the scientific spirit. There was, as we say, a revolt of reason. So they said, if this religion and Bible is one man's rule, called the priest or the pope or the fathers, now they wanted something where every man could read the same Bible. And every man who could read the common book was the common book of nature, where you could see nature, you could observe nature, where you could experiment with nature, and that is what is called physical science. So this is how scientific spirit came in the West very early. Because they did not want this exclusive attention of religion dominating our life. They said, let us have some common ground where nobody can have a single authority. And science offered that open book of nature. She said, welcome, anyone and everyone is welcome to my book. They can all read nature and you can all discover my secrets. So this is how there was a revolt of reason, and out of that, all of you know, industrialism came up, expansionism came up, colonialism came up. All those are external formations of the same spirit. But if you see in the East means Asia, India, Japan, China, Thailand, you see any Eastern country, they were quietly in a deep sleep in the conventional age. There was no question of any revolt, anybody revolting and coming forward. So even though it looks hard, it looks really pathetic, that we have lost so many lives under the British rule, but Sri Aurobindo says it was the destiny of the Britishers, it was nature and Godhead and Providence who decided to bring the Western power to the East. Why? To awaken the East from its slumber of conventional age. You see, when you are sleeping in a deep sleep, somebody has to wake you up. If you don't wake up, somebody has to kick you hard. And unfortunately, the deeper the slumber a country was in, the deeper the kick it had, the harder the kick it had. And this is why England, as somebody yesterday was telling, a small country, how could it conquer a big country like India? It is not it is more intelligent than India. It is not more intelligent than Indians. But it did have some kind of this unique spirit, which we call the individualistic spirit, which was necessary for the countries of Asia. So it was not the question of small or big, intelligence or not intelligence. It was because in the world, as you see, it's very obvious today, no country can advance faster than the others. There's always a kind of a forward and backward movement, and everyone is moving together somehow. You see, today in this present economic situation, India is supposed to be one of the last ones. But somehow in the last 5-7 years, it's been bucked up and we are catching on with the others. So all the time in nature, there is a perfect balance of advancement. Because as we were discussing yesterday, the whole world is a single expression of a single Lord. He will not be partial to one country that goes much in advance and the others are all backward. It is after all His creation. But there is a kind of a rhythm. So when the East was slumbering, the West had awakened, then nature sent West to East to awaken it for its own greatness. And this is where comes the incoming of the British rule in India. And the second characteristic of Britishers, Sri Aurobindo calls, is their sense of commerce, the sense of commercial attitude, this commercial acumen. And this is the role of England in the world. Because as we were saying yesterday, that every nation contributes its mite to the evolution of the world. And just like Greece and Rome contributed the sense of beauty and law to the entire world, similarly, the exclusive contribution of Britishers, of England, is the sense of this commercial acumen. Because it is they who have brought the rule of aristocracy to the level of bourgeoisie. The rule of the Kshatriyas, they shifted from Kshatriya to the Vaishya. Because this is necessary in the evolution, as we were saying yesterday, evolution moves on from a Brahminhood to Kshatriyahood, to Vaishyahood, to Shudrahood. And it is in this transition, you can see when Britishers came, what was India? 100 people, 100 kings were there, who were all Kshatriyas. But their role was over. Because when India needed the Kshatriyahood, like any other country in the world, all these great kings have come. Because you see, every nation has to go through the same format. Brahminhood, Kshatriyahood, Vaishyahood, Shudrahood. So India too awoke in the right time for its Kshatriyahood, but a Kshatriyahood that lasted too long and started rotting. And all our Indian kings were just in the last frustrating end of a Kshatriyahood. But they would not go out, they cannot go out. So nature had to bring forth an external power called the Britishers, who removed the Kshatriyahood from the aristocracy to bourgeois. So it's in this transition of a nation called India from a Kshatriyahood to bourgeoisie that England had to come. So the British rule gave India not that one single map, all that the politicians say, historians say, but in the level of the spiritual conquest, of the spiritual evolution, what the Britishers gave was this transition from Kshatriyahood to Vaishyahood, and secondly from the conventional age to the individual age. Because remember, under the pressure of the British rule towards the end of the 18th century, we had all those great figures like Raja Ram Mohan Roy, who came up as individuals breaking the molds of the past of the Indian conventional age. So they did have a tremendous impact. And Sri Aurobindo says one more thing that the British gave to India was the power of thinking. Because in his Foundations of Indian Culture, Sri Aurobindo analyzes that the main cause of the fall of India is not because it has no strength or intelligence or power or wealth, but because we had stagnated in our original thinking. That means this individual thinking was under stagnation with the Mughals and all that. We had become completely, lotus eaters. We were enjoying a nice culture, but we had lost the power of self-thinking. So these were some of the contributions. And this is how we have to see, however much we may dislike what they did to Mahatma Gandhi and all these revolutionaries they killed in thousands and thousands. But this is what a nation has to pay. Because if it doesn't awaken in time, nation pays much harder. So in this impact of the East and West, all the smaller countries, you see Taiwan and Cambodia and Japan and all those countries, Thailand and Burma, he says those are countries which live on their surface soul. That means a country like India, it lives in a great depth. And that's why for it to awaken and to come to the surface takes a longer time. In fact, in one sentence I remember, he says, India is like a big elephant. Its movements are slow but steady and its march is eternal. But its movements are very slow. But maybe the other smaller countries, they could catch up with this individualistic age very fast. And that is why you see all the Far Eastern countries have developed so fast in this competition of the economic game, and they have even superseded the Western countries. However, so this is what is the individualistic age. But unfortunately, your question was, why are we at this stage still? Exactly because of this. That although we have been given the shock treatment, we have not yet come forward in this individualistic age. It is now things are happening. And in this individualistic age, what is the connection between Kshatriyahood and this individualistic age? You can see now, when the economy, when the Vaishyahood comes and rules a country, when economy develops, then all these questions of caste systems, power systems, they change. There is a breakdown of all the divisions in a society, because there is a coming togetherness. Economy has a great power. It's not just the money power alone, but it brings forth a unity in the society also. Because I've seen in Bangkok with my own experience, how it brings different values in the society. Values, positive values. One of those things is they break the class divisions. And so if India has to get rid of its cancer, which is this caste system, one of its solutions is a good economic growth. Even today, if a low class man becomes a rich man, people forget. But if the low class man remains a poor man, people will say, "Oh, he's a low class man. Don't give my daughter to him." I've seen in Hyderabad many cases. When a man is poor, we say he's class. When he's rich, he's beyond classes. I mean, this is a social thinking that comes in. But in Thailand, it has worked miracles, I can tell you that. But from this individualistic age, the West went forward. They sought the subjective. Who exactly is this man? Now that we are all free, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, then the Western people started asking, who is man after all? Is he an animal? Aristotle had described. Is he anything else? So there was a search of a true man. Because remember, the Western world had conquered the external world. They had colonized all that was possible. But then there was a movement within the inner man. And there comes all your modern paintings, modern music. The greatest example is Picasso himself, where you see all those, you must have seen hundreds of exhibitions where the form lost its meaning and you are just splashes of colors, strange forms, strange, colors, dazzling colors. And of course it went to a fiasco also, it went to an extreme. But Sri Aurobindo would say that also is a search for one's true self. But unfortunately, the Western mind, what it is, could not go into the deeper level. It got stuck at the subconscious level. That means instead of finding out the true psychic being, they found out the subconscious, which is the darker side of man. Even the psychology cannot be a real treatment. When we have psychotherapies, these therapies in the West, I don't think it's any successful at all. Because they have taken a wrong road. That means they think that trying to awaken the subconscious, clear the subconscious, is going to give you the psychotherapy. This is where comes the role of India. That Sri Aurobindo says, India has been given this great and unique knowledge of spirituality. So in the coming age, which is the age of spirituality, because you see we have gone through symbolic, typal, conventional, individual, especially in the West, and unfortunately West has gone astray on the subjective age, and Sri Aurobindo says, the spiritual age for which they are looking forward to, India has a role. Because the true individual in man is not his external personality, but the inner soul, Atman. And this knowledge was given to India way back in the times of the Vedas. So this is where automatically you see the curve ends almost in India. That the knowledge which it was given, it has to bring forth. So this is where Sri Aurobindo would say, there's a beautiful line here, I mean a paragraph. He says, a great light is dawning in the east. A light whose first heralding glimpses are already seen on the horizon. A new day is about to break, so glorious that even the last of the avatars cannot be sufficient to explain it. Although without him, it would not have come. That him is referring to Sri Ramakrishna. The perfect expression of Hindu spirituality was the signal of the resurgence of the East. Mankind has long been experimenting with various kinds of thought, different principles of ethics, strange dreams of a perfection to be gained by material means, impossible millenniums and humanitarian hopes. Nowhere has it succeeded in realizing the ultimate secret of life. Nowhere has it found satisfaction. No scheme of society or politics has helped it to escape from the necessity of sorrow, poverty, strife, dissatisfaction from which it strives for an outlet. For whoever is trying to find one by material means must inevitably fail. The East alone has some knowledge of the truth. The East alone can teach the West. The East alone can save mankind. Imagine, because the save is, that means the saving with the true knowledge of the psychic being, of the soul. Through all these ages, Asia has been seeking for a new light within. And whenever she has been blessed with a glimpse of what she seeks, a great religion has been born. Buddhism, Confucianism, Christianity, Mohammedanism, with all their countless sects. But the grand workshop of spiritual experiment, the laboratory of the soul, has been India, where thousands of great spirits have been born in every generation who are content to work quietly in their own souls, perfect their knowledge, hand down the results of their experiments to a few disciples, and leave the rest to others to complete. Of all these souls, Sri Ramakrishna was the last and greatest. For while others felt God in a single or limited aspect, he felt him in his illimitable unity as a sum of an illimitable variety. In him the spiritual experience of the millions of saints who had gone before were renewed and united. Sri Ramakrishna gave to India the final message of Hinduism to the world. A new era dates from his birth, an era in which the peoples of the earth will be lifted for a while into communion with God, and spirituality become the dominant note of human life. What Christianity failed to do, what Mohammedanism strove to accomplish in times as yet unripe, what Buddhism half accomplished For a brief period and among a limited number of men, Hinduism, as summed up in the life of Sri Ramakrishna, has to attempt for all the world. This is the reason for India's resurgence. This is why God has breathed life into her once more. Why great souls are at work to bring about her salvation. Why a sudden change is coming over the hearts of her sons. The movement of which the first outbreak was political will end in a spiritual consummation. So you see, this is, not a common man will not see this oncoming. But this is where Sri Aurobindo sees the new light. And in this, there is a specific thing. When we say that what is it that India has to offer, yes, he says, the spiritual light. But can we go a little more specific? And there, find out what exactly do we mean by the spiritual light that India has to offer. Well, here, I'll take you into a little more detail. What exactly is the India's role? Because this is clear that our destiny, India's destiny, is to bring back the old knowledge. But what exactly do we mean by this old spiritual knowledge? Again, in some book, in the Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo mentions that in the evolution of mankind, there are four stages. You see, each time I'm giving you different stages, different levels, but maybe if you take notes or remember later, you'll see they all converge into one thing. But Sri Aurobindo is one who looks at a problem from different angles, so he's giving us different analysis. In this one, he says, the first level of spiritual evolution of man was religion. Obviously, we know from the Vedic times, that what was the first thing that was born in humanity to make it a little more civilized country, civilized people, was religion. Religion was the first birth of man, which in fact civilized humanity. Well, I don't have to deal more in detail, how it brought us a different notion of Godhead, it took us towards Godhead, it made us a little more pure in our beings. Religion's main function has been a purification, not an elevation. It's more an ethical purification of our nature. It has not transformed man, but it has purified man. That was, he says, on the physical level. Then on the vital level, he says there is the occultism and mysticism. That means when man went forward in his civilization, he became more occult and mystic. Where we see all the mystic people, occultism in practice in Egypt, in Tibet and in China. This was the occultism. This was a higher rung of evolution. Then on the mental level, he says there is the spiritual knowledge. So when man becomes mental in the last so many centuries, what he is after is not much of occultism and religion. Religion has become a basic need. Every common man wants to be a Hindu or a Christian and wants to follow those isms, those external ceremonies. That is the lowest rung of human civilization. A man who is really into the physical level, not much of a great intellect or anything. But once a man becomes a strongly intellectual person, a strongly mental person, he wants to know. Spiritual knowledge is what he is after. He is no more satisfied with the daily routine of religious formalities, religious ceremonies. He wants to know what exactly is spiritual knowledge. This has come in the West also, in the East also. But the last stage where we have to move forward, he says, is a spiritual experience. And Sri Aurobindo says, in transferring spiritual knowledge into spiritual experience, is the India's greatness. How does it do? It does through the process of yoga. So here comes the most important point of India's contribution to the future world.